Hey, welcome to the Life 2.0 podcast. I'm John St. Augustine. Glad to have you joining me from wherever you're listening at in the world. Time to go up the down staircase in the outdoor, make sense out of the senseless, and if at all possible, find the obvious buried in the absurd. Let's get to it. Like I said, we're back at it on the Life 2.0 podcast. You know, I've been doing this particular podcast goes into its third year now, and I got 25 years in radio. I never even thought this would be an option for me, but you know what? Technology changes things, and I don't sit in a technical formatted studio as much as I used to anymore when in the old radio days, but the opportunity to speak to people all over the world from my home studio is still mind-boggling to me. The reason I bring this up is because I'm going to have Dr. Jeff O'Driscoll on in just a second, and it took us 20 minutes. He's a doctor, and I have a degree in broadcasting, and neither one of us could figure out how to get the effing thing to work, so it's always good to do that. I want to bring Jeff on real quick. Have you join me today? Thanks so much.
Oh, it's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
So you're in Utah.
I am. I'm in Utah, and we're just about to start our ski season.
Nice, nice. So, in full disclosure, which I always find the best way to go about things, our mutual friend Jennifer Weigel reached out to me and said, listen, you got to meet this guy. You know, he's the kind of guy that you could actually go sit with and have a beer and discuss the things that I've written about and she's written about and you've experienced and you've written about. And I think that there's sometimes a sense of normalcy when people who, for example, football and rodeo at one time was part of your life. And I think when you come from that authenticity, people tend to pay attention a little bit more. I could read your bio. It would take the whole show, so I'm not going to do that. But just in a nutshell, can you kind of give the audience a little bit of where you were and where you're at now, how this all kind of came about? You were an ER doctor for many years. And, you know, you did all the typical training. But then things started to kind of go into a different direction.
Things started to go in a different direction for me very early in life, actually. I grew up in rural Utah, hauling hay, riding horses, and there was one thing I swore I'd never do, and that was go to college. Mm. And somewhere along the way, I made one wrong turn, and 15 years later, I ended up as an emergency physician.
15 years.
So you never quite know what to expect. But yeah. I loved your intro where you talked about going in the outdoor, and mm-hmm. you gave a couple other examples, because for me, I was right in the middle of an academically oriented, science-based, evidence-driven emergency medicine career, and I was having these profound spiritual experiences that science couldn't explain, but mm-hmm. I couldn't deny. Things like actually seeing patients' essence or consciousness or soul leave their body when they died, and they'd communicate with me before they left, and they just didn't talk about that in medical school. And so it was a bit of a conflict at times.
Mm. Going back even before all of that, you lost your brother when he was a teenager. And one of the things that I've watched some of the videos and interviews you've done, I listened to the great interview you did with Jen not that long ago. And one of the things you point out is that, you know, there seems to be a deep longing in us. You know, either you think you're a spiritual being having a human experience, or you're a human being having a spiritual experience, and you kind of go vacillate back and forth between the two. But sometimes you talk about, you know, that people want to have a spiritual experience. There's a deep need for that to kind of validate something. We just don't want to suffer or die for it. But you went through some pain as a young man. Do you think that that's kind of what started this whole ball rolling in that direction, even without knowing it back then?
I do believe that now. And as you said, I didn't know it back then. I didn't think of it back then. For 25 years, I didn't talk about my spiritual experiences in the emergency department. And then when I finally started talking about them, people frequently asked me the question, when did this start and how did this happen for you? And it caused me some soul searching. And I went back to June, the month before my 12th birthday, when my older brother, to whom I was very close, died in a farm accident. He tipped a tractor over. I didn't think it had any major psychological impact on me. I saw the pain that it caused my parents, but I didn't think it really changed me in any significant way until 20 years later. My brother came to me. And he said, you have to go talk with our mother. There's things she's never told you about my death.
Wow.
And that got my attention. So I went and sat down with my mother on a beautiful sunny day. It was just the two of us. We had a long conversation. And she told me that day for the very first time, she said, I always knew where you were in the house before Stan died because I could hear you singing. When your brother died, you stopped singing. And that was the first time I really realized that his departure had written on my soul and changed who I was. And it wasn't long after his death that I first started getting messages.
Hmm. You know, when you, in saying this, you know, people listening to this show, and again, this is stuff that I've garnered myself over time. I heard you talk about it. Jennifer's brought up as well. All the books that she talks about with people that have had experiences, and I'll leave it there. People can define that for themselves. Is that a lot of times, as you said, you went 20, 25 years in silence with this stuff, which can eat you up. To me, that's like serious spiritual constipation, right? This stuff builds up and builds up and builds up, and at some point it's got to pop. And I think a lot of people have something they can't quite explain or define, scares them, so they don't share it at all. But when you sat down with your mom, I can't even imagine the load that must have been off her and the awakening, however that kind of plays out for you. I mean, it was years in the making for that to take place. It's just astonishing.
It is astonishing, and it's still amazing to me today how the little details kind of coalesce to bring things to a certain point where you finally have one of those aha moments, mm-hmm. and you go, oh, this is what this has mm-hmm. been about for all these years. I get it now.
The email that's been bouncing back and forth, as Jennifer set us up before the show, said connecting the dots. And I look at life that way. You know, it's connect the dots. You never really get a chance to see what the dots are in front of you. It's only when you look back and you see the picture that's made, the route that you've taken. And your route includes things, and I told you off the air, you know, and when I did the intro, if you're doing rodeo and playing football at some point, I know you and I can connect. And I think it's that authenticity, that grounded kind of manners that you have and the way that you approach things, that you're really clear about who you are and even clearer maybe about who you're not.
I try to be clear. I think if we're really going to live an authentic life, if we're really going to be connected to our highest self and find our purpose for why we're here, I think we have to be authentic, and I think we have to be clear what we are and what we're not. And I've always been comfortable with what I am. I didn't not talk about my experiences because I doubted them. I didn't talk about them because it just didn't feel right for some reason. I think there might have been some concern about my professional reputation and my medical career. I think there was a sense often that maybe the experiences were just a little bit too sacred to talk about out loud. Mm. And there were some other things. And then a few years ago, it came the right time for me to stop seeing patients in the emergency department. And about 6 months later, I just woke up one day and something clicked deep in my soul, and I understood it was okay to talk about it. Hmm. And that's when I started to share with a few select friends that I trusted. And within six months, I'd published my book, and I had friends arranging for me to speak on speaking engagements. And so it was a dramatic change, but it felt just as right to not talk about it for a long time as it suddenly felt to talk about it.
You know, so much of what happens around death is connected and termed loss. And I've had two times in my life where I'm not, quote, supposed to be here. The first time when I was 19, I was electrocuted, gone, done, that's it, see ya. And the pharmacist where I was working just, quote, happened to stay late and revived me and came back. And I did not have any huge epiphanies. I mean, I was 19 and bulletproof, and I was gone and I was back, and there was nothing like super sacred about it. And I got some money out enough to buy a 1969 Camaro, and that was good to go. And then when I was 27, I was in a car accident 3 weeks after I was married, and that was a whole different deal. That was literally getting knocked out of my body at 75 miles an hour. And when I look back on those things, I realize it was a process of getting my attention, in my opinion. And I think that life is constantly trying to get our attention. We don't often pay that much attention. We're so wrapped up and out there in headlines and breaking news and all these distractions. It's very difficult, I think, Jeff, for people to reconnect with that part of themselves, that quiet part of themselves, that still small voice within them. And yet maybe these, I used to think they were accidents. I call them incidents now because accident means it was kind of not supposed to happen. But for me, incidents are supposed to be part of my life. So it seems to be maybe the loss and difficulty and pain and disconnect and all these trials and tribulations we go through in disguise may be opportunities we're missing.
I agree completely. There are things that happen in our lives that get our attention, and those things are different for every person, which is one of the reasons it's so important that we not judge another person's experience, because it may be tailored for exactly what they need, even if we don't see the significance in it. I had an experience when I was 16. I was just kind of getting used to these messages, and I was driving a Volkswagen Bug much too fast, probably as fast as it would go, on a narrow, windy country road after dark. I had two friends in the car. None of us were wearing seat belts. And a voice spoke to me and said, "You have to slow down." And I've joked since that I was in a very rebellious time in my life. I wouldn't have listened to law enforcement. I wouldn't have listened to my parents. And if God had been sitting in the seat next to me, I wouldn't have listened to God. But that voice wrapped itself around my heart, and I felt it, and I slowed down. I went around the corner and hit a Cadillac head on.
Whoa.
Nobody was injured, but there was a lot of damage. And I think if I hadn't have heard that voice and listened to it, I might have died that night. And I later came to appreciate the fact that it was my brother's voice. And that's the only voice that I would have listened to, because when I was, I don't know if you have an older brother or not, but anybody that has an older brother can relate with this. I believed everything he told me.
Yeah.
I looked up to him. I adored him. And I think his is the only voice I would have listened to on that night, on that circumstance. And I think it saved my life.
You know, there's a lot of magic in the world. And I have always found it, usually it's not on some bright shining billboard with flashing lights saying, "Look here," it's in the corners and the crevices of our lives. I have found the most extraordinary things are usually in the ordinary places. But again, we're very distracted, especially in the 21st century with all this stuff. I was, you know, half kidding that, you know, you're a doctor, you've treated over 60,000 patients. I got 25 years in radio, and I forgot to tell you that only Google Chrome is what we can use here. You know, it's like my brain, I think I have turbulent mind syndrome at this point. I'm always trying to calm it down. But the, you know,
I like that.
Yeah, it's a thing. It's a real thing, you know. And so, but you mentioned the book that you wrote. It's called Not Yet. And you come from this place of, A, it's not a religious book. And, you know, that kind of is for everybody. When I heard you doing one of the interviews talking about the difference between spirituality and religion, I've always related it to like I go back to the cars that I've driven, and, you know, the body always looks different, the model, whatever it may be, but the power plant usually has the same thing. So the spirituality is what drives you, how you put it around you, how do you go to church or how you pray? I mean, that's an individual thing. But one of the principles you bring up in the book, among the few, is this whole concept of believing and being willing. There's two of them there. And that great point you make, that experiences come to skeptics, but they more often come to people who believe. Can you expand on that a little bit?
I think it gets back to what you mentioned earlier about being still and hearing. It's really hard to hear someone whispering at you if you're in a rock concert and the noise is loud. When you get the distractions low enough, then you start to hear those messages that come from various sources, be they in your mind an external source, a divine source, an angelic source, or whether it is your own highest self and your own divine nature that's speaking to you. You have to get quiet to hear it. And part of the path of being centered and authentic is learning to be quiet enough to get the direction you need, to get the messages. And when I say that, I'm quick to add, we shouldn't always think that we look outward for the message, because the message often comes from within. I've studied a lot of religion around the world. I studied the Bhagavad Gita of the Hindus. I've studied the Quran. I learned Hebrew to study the Torah. I've studied the Christian New Testament and other sacred and ancient texts. And there's this thing that's very common in many cultures that has to do with temples or sacred places of worship. And all the way back in ancient Israel in the Torah. It's about this notion of entering a sacred space and then circumambulating up into the center, which is the symbolic seat of God. That's where God resides, is in the center. No place during your instruction or your initiation or what in these various ceremonies are you instructed to go to the window and draw back the drape and look outward for your answer. So in these many cultures where it talks about our bodies being the temple, if we enter this body, we should remember that symbolism. Often the answer is up and to the center, not outward, not looking someplace else for it. We have to get connected to our authentic self, and the way we do that is we have to quiet all the distractions and be open to receiving.
I'm not exactly sure who the quote is attributed to, but something to the effect that all of humanity's ills comes from our inability to sit alone by ourselves for 30 minutes in a room and deal with it. You know, just who we, and we have to be entertained 24/7, 365. I think that there's a, my background's in kinesiology. My secondary degree is in kinesiology and movement and stuff. And there's a principle in kinesiology, SAID, specific adaptation to imposed demands. And that's why if you swim for a long time and you have the right genetics, you look like Michael Phelps. I don't, right? So it's all how you develop what the demand is placed on you or what demand you place on yourself. And when I look at the way the world is now and the demands that are placed on us that draw us out constantly, you know, whether it's a cell phone or you got to get breaking news or you got the TV on or whatever, everything pulls us away from that center, that sacred center of ourselves. What are some of the things that you suggest people do in order to kind of get back into where they need to be?
Finding time for yourself is very important. Self-care is not selfish. You have to take care of your soul. You have to feed and nourish that part of you that's eternal, that's sacred, that's spiritual. And we hear a lot of talk about meditation, but a lot of people get hung up in the definition of meditation. They get really rigid about what constitutes meditation, having your mind completely clear of everything and sitting in quietness. But I'm a firm believer that we shouldn't be so rigid about these things, because for some people, a music meditation works much better. For some people, a guided meditation works well. A moving meditation where you're exercising. I get great downloads when I'm out running or when I'm on my bicycle. I have one friend who told me, she said, I tried meditating once. It was hell. She has attention deficit.
Well, there you go. Disorder. I can imagine.
And so it would be hell. Yeah. So what you need to do is adapt a practice that resonates with you and fits your style and your approach. And it's a place where you get connected, and let it be whatever it is. I have one client in Singapore who gets all her downloads in the morning in the shower.
Oh, wow.
And she thought she had no morning routine. She got frustrated when I asked her once about her morning routine. She said, I don't have any, and she was really short about it. And then she told me about how she checks her social media first thing in the morning, which most spiritual leaders mm-hmm. would tell you not to do. But that's how she connects with her tribe. She sees what all her people are doing, and she knows what they need. And then she takes a shower, and she gets all these downloads that clarify things for the day for her. And I told her, I said, sorry to tell you this, but you have a morning routine. It just doesn't look like other people's.
Yeah. You know, and so just, that's a great point, because, you know, we're all very different. I think that the wiring harness is basically the same, but the connecting points are different in everybody, and understanding what moves you and what doesn't is really, really important. And the thought I had while you were talking about that, you know, is that this download concept, the divine download or whatever you want to call it, if you can expand on that. I mean, I remember reading a book, Think and Grow Rich, Napoleon Hill, classic, 1938. And in there, he talked about a guy named Dr. Gates. And all Dr. Gates apparently did was sit in a room that was dark and wait for ideas to show up and then turn a light on a little foot switch and then write down the ideas. And I don't know how many patents this guy came up with. But he shoved himself away from everything and just stayed within there. And this was a download process for him. So this concept of downloads, which we all use the term all the time now, isn't exactly what you're talking about, but the process is the same, as we're waiting for something to come in that we could use or gives us some information. But Jeff, my question is, is it like in the cloud somewhere? Where does it come from, in your opinion?
I believe, based on my studies and experience, that we are all divine beings and that we existed before we were born. and that when we leave our bodies, we continue to exist as divine spiritual beings. And the body is, in essence, a veil that causes us to forget where we've come from and what we knew. And so I think the downloads quite frequently are recollections. They're remembering things about who we are, where we came from, why we're here. And one of the things that really resonates with me when I get some direction or a voice or a message or a download is when I have that moment and I go, oh, yeah, of course, I get it now. Hmm. That makes sense. And for me, that's always kind of a click to go, yeah, that's truth. That's coming from source, and you can trust it because it feels so familiar and so appropriate for the circumstance.
Hmm. You know, this is obvious. This is not taught in schools. There's nothing about, you know, following your intuition 101. There should be. So much of what life for me has been is an unlearning process. It's a peeling away process. One of my biggest movements in my life that ever came from an inner thing, and people who've read my first book, and I think that's in the third book, the last one I just did, was when I was in a very difficult time in my life, and I thought I had done everything correctly. I was in the service. I went to college. Everything all the boxes were checked off, got married, all that stuff was in order. And things still, in my opinion at the time, fell apart. And I did not understand the concept. This was in 1995 and 6. I didn't understand the concept of like taking the puzzle box when you got the puzzle all done, put it back in and shaking it up again, and then having to redo the puzzle. I had no idea what that was like. And my subconscious mind started showing me a picture. And the picture was me standing on the side of the road with a backpack on, with a stick in my left hand, a big beard, and the sun was on my left, that's all I know, and there was water nearby, and I would wake up. This happened every day for 4 months, right before I woke up. It was driving me nuts. It literally was. I couldn't control it. I didn't know what it meant. I was in the middle of this difficulty. The people I told were like, yeah, maybe you should just start walking somewhere, right? And again, this was this pulling apart process. The long and short of it is, we eventually moved at the time to I called a friend of mine who's a Native American. He lived in the UP of Michigan, and I had been going back and forth with him talking about this dream that wouldn't leave me alone. He said, well, maybe you're supposed to move up here. And I thought, what the hell am I going to do up there? So we moved there. And within 2 weeks of moving there, the dream started again. So I went to this guy and I said, look, this is what's going on. And he says, come on out back. And he had this big lodge on their property. And we went out back and he was standing there holding my hand. He's like 5 foot tall and 5 foot wide. And he says, you're being given a choice. Most people don't pay attention to this. You're being offered an opportunity to do something. And if you listen to it, you know, the dominoes are going to fall one way. And if you don't, they'll go another way. So I decided to listen to it. And I realized as soon as I said yes, that I will listen, the plan started to take its own form. And in short order, myself and another guy and one other guy, I didn't know these other guys when I moved there, basically, we all walked from the Upper Peninsula to Chicago and back on foot. That's 1,000 miles round trip. Nothing. I was 37 years old. We're living in a motel. I got nothing going on, but I knew I had to do this. We got to Chicago. Those guys stayed for a couple days. They went back home, and then I walked north on foot by myself. And that's when the wheels really started to come off on who I used to be. And outside of Oconomowoc, Wisconsin, I found myself standing in the exact same image that I'd been seeing for months. Side of the road, backpack on, big beard, stick in my left hand, water on the left. Couldn't effing believe it. Listen, in Chicago, we don't even put ketchup on our hot dogs, Jeff. So you're asking a guy like me to believe in this stuff? But something was breaking open. And the moment I realized that was happening, I heard this voice as clear as a bell on a cold day say, John, go on the radio. I had no training, no nothing. Living in a motel. And oh, sure, that's like a good idea. The long and short, I got back a day before Thanksgiving in 1996. This is about a four-month trek. Slept for 3 or 4 days. I thought things would happen right away, like some magical wand would come down and all of a sudden I'd be on the radio. That didn't happen. But a year later, I finally got a chance to go on the air, and I've been doing it ever since for 25 years. And I have no training in this. But my point in saying this is I want to illustrate for people listening to the show the point you were making, that there is some sort of remembrance I have with this. I don't know where it comes from. That's why I asked you, because I'm not exactly sure what that is. I don't have an older brother. I don't know whose voice it was. But I'm just glad that I listened, because it has taken me on a road and a trip that in some ways I think was already pre-planned, but you also have free will to say yay or nay.
I love that story. That's a beautiful story. The reason it unfolded is because you chose to act. Mm-hmm. You chose to do something about it. And one of the things I work with my clients on to help them understand, I say, listen, if you ponder and you search and you dig around and you conclude that the voice you're listening to is your own, it's still divine. Follow it.
I've never heard go off the radio, so I'm still at it. I never heard stop. I heard just start. You know, in all of this, you know, people listening, you know, they're used to hearing these conversations that I've had with people like you and others and my own stuff. But I always think that there's a permission factor here, that I like to think when I do these type of shows, and I've done shows that covered everything, you know, under the human condition we can. But when we do shows like this and have these conversations, my hope is that there's a permission granted, that somebody listening somewhere doesn't ignore that voice anymore, that still small voice, or they start to realize there's patterns taking place. So like your friend in Singapore that I didn't know I had a routine, and apparently I do. Those type of little things that can happen for people can yield big results, correct?
They can yield huge results. I just spoke in September to the International Association for Near-Death Studies. And it was their conference. And my topic was normalizing shared death experiences among healthcare providers. There's a terminology used in certain circles. Shared death experiences have to do with having some kind of a paranormal or spiritual experience associated with the death of somebody. And it happens a lot in the medical field because a lot of people are going through that transition. So it's very common for nurses, maybe not quite as common for doctors, to have some kind of a profound experience at the bedside. Let me give you an example. I have a friend who I didn't know 25 years ago, who was involved in a bad car crash a couple hundred miles away from where I was practicing medicine. And in the crash took the life of his wife of 10 years and his 14-month-old son and nearly killed him. He was flown to my trauma center. And when I went into the trauma room, he was unconscious and motionless on a gurney, and there was an army of providers taking care of him. Standing above his gurney in the air was his deceased wife, Tamara, whom I had also never met. Met her for the first time that night. And she communicated with me, and we had this profound experience. I walked over and I looked down at Jeff's leg that had been badly injured, and I remember thinking, oh, he's going to lose the leg. And as I looked down at his leg, I could still see Tamara standing behind me in the air because I could see in all directions at the same time. And about a month later, we sent Jeff, that was his name too, we sent him off to the operating room. I went back and finished my shift and went home. I never expected to see him again. But a month later, I talked with him in his hospital room. A nurse who had a similar spiritual experience that night of his trauma insisted that we go and talk with him. And so she drugged me up to his hospital room and proceeded to tell him about this experience where his deceased wife had come to the trauma room. And as we talked, he got emotional and divulged the fact that before his body was even extricated from the vehicle, he'd left his body and met his wife, Tamara, in the air above the scene of the accident. And she said, you have to go back and raise our other son, because they had another child that was not severely injured in the accident. And Jeff and I are still good friends today. In fact, when I went to see him outside the hospital for the first time, he said he saw my cowboy boots and jeans and a bull riding belt buckle, and he thought, oh, I can trust this guy.
There you go.
But that's an example of a shared death experience. I was perfectly healthy. I wasn't on any medications. I wasn't having a seizure. I wasn't on drugs. And I had this profound experience associated with the passing of another individual. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of this in medicine. And that was my topic that I was talking about, how to normalize these things. And the first step in normalizing these kind of experiences is to talk about them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because almost every time you talk about it, somebody goes, oh, you know, I had an experience similar to that once.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and the resistance to this, it is what it is. You know, I think everybody does what they can where they are with what they have. What someone may read your book and they go, wow, this is it. And somebody doesn't get anything, but something else trips their trigger. As you said, it's all kind of individualized. But there is a resistance. You know, I think it comes out of misinformation. It comes out of being disconnected from whatever source we decide to call it, and all those pieces play a role in that. But
so much of it comes out of fear too.
I can't even imagine. I mean, who wants? Right, I don't want to see my dead uncle show up. Then it happens anyway, you know. And I have found over time that information I go back to this permission thing, can lessen that fear a little bit. And so when you go out and talk to folks, and I'm waiting for like this big aha still piece for you, like, you know, we're in a college guy, you end up being an MD, you end up working in an ER, which set up everything else. And I'm trying to go back before, you know, you lost your brother to influences, because I keep thinking like in The Wizard of Oz, man, they're going to go out and they're going to go on the yellow brick road. And the beginning of the yellow brick road is a tiny splash of yellow. And nothing starts happening until she gets on the path and all this other stuff takes place. And I'll get to that in a second. But this background of yours, as you mentioned, you know, helping people lessen the fear around this. You were a healer in the ER. You spent all this time with people. You are basically a healer in a different ER, basically the earth room instead of the emergency room. And do you see the correlation between the two, Jeff, that the traditional ER kind of set up this work that you do?
I didn't initially, but I do now. I never thought of myself as a healer. I was just helping people take care of their bodies. And when I wrote my book and I started to talk about some of these things a little bit, a friend of mine looked at me one day and he said, "I think you're a healer." And I said, "Oh, no, I don't do that."
Yeah, yeah.
And he looked at me sincerely and he said, I said, "There's only one healer." And he said, "I disagree. I think you're a healer and I think you should ask for permission to use the word." So I came home, and as I mentioned earlier, sometimes I get good downloads when I'm running. So I came home, I changed my clothes, I went out for a run. And as I was running, I asked the question, "Is it okay to call myself a healer?" And this divine being came to me that I felt so familiar and comfortable with. And on this occasion, it was a male figure. And he kind of chuckled at my question. And he said, "Of course, I made you a healer." And I got this download of all this information with those few words. I understood, oh, he's not diminished by my successes. If I'm a really good healer, it doesn't make him less.
Mm.
And he's not jealous or insecure. And I understood all this in an instant as I got those few words. Of course, I made you a healer. And that was the day I came home and put healer on my business card and on my website. And so, yeah, I do get the correlation now, but I was slow to come to it.
Mm. So the fear factor that goes into all this, you know, depending on who you talk to, resides in the ego, that false self, that protective membrane that wraps us so tightly sometimes. And, you know, I like to think that we all come into this playground basically the same route, and then, ready to go, blank slate, let's get going, let's get about our business, and then all the shit starts piling on top of you for like the first 25 years of life. Then you spend the rest of your life trying to unpile this stuff off so you can remember who you are. And I think of the ego as this, you know, this all-knowing, all-being, all-seeing entity. It thinks, it doesn't really, in my opinion, consider that there's anything outside of it. This is me, and this is who it is. So when you talk about some sort of a creator outside of the ego, I think it brings up the fear in people that how could that possibly be? And I think that we've confused having everything with knowing everything, and we don't. We have everything in our fingertips for the most part. And somehow that has got lost in translation, that we know everything, and we for sure don't. Look, I'm a, you know, at my most basic form, I'm a knuckle-dragging ex-jock who got knocked around quite a bit and finally listened and woke up. And when I go back to the guys I played semi-pro football with, they're like, they can't believe the transformation. Neither can I. I don't float around. I don't walk on water. I'm not doing any palm readings. I'm just very, very aware of the fact that I've been given something to do. And the one thing that I've been given to do is to bring people together. The world is about pushing people apart. I'm supposed to find ways to put people within vicinity and of each other and let them learn about each other, which can be a healing thing. And radio has been, and speaking and books, but mostly radio has been the platform for that, for me to do that. And I keep thinking about the ego in all of this, and I'm wondering what your definition is of that.
That's a great question. And let me answer it by sharing an experience I had in the emergency department, which kind of gives balance to this notion of some grand external creator, okay? I walked into a room. It was about this time of year, maybe a little bit later in November. There was snow on the ground, and the patient was the only other person in the room. He had on these disheveled, soiled clothes. He had long, shaggy hair and a big beard. He had holes in his shoes, and through the holes in his shoes, I could see the holes in his socks, and through the holes in his socks, I could see his feet, and I knew they were in rough shape because he'd been wearing cold, wet shoes and socks for a prolonged period of time. He struggled with substance use. He was homeless. He had a very rough life, as we view it generally. And he knew what needed to be done. I knew what needed to be done. I grabbed a wash basin. I filled it with warm water. I squirted some soap in it, and I sat down at the foot of the gurney with a wash rag. I took off his shoes. I pulled off the last threads of his socks, and I lowered his feet into the water, and I washed his feet. And something profound happened that I can't explain, but everything that was temporal, everything that was physical or mortal was drawn back, and I saw his soul. I saw who he was, and I understood I was in the presence of God. And I'm not exaggerating. I was in the presence of the divine. He was the antithesis of everything that I'd been taught was success in the world. I went in there thinking I was going to serve him, and I had this realization, no, he's here to minister to you, to teach you who you are. Because I understood that I was the same and that every soul is that. We're always next to God, whether we're sitting in the pews in church or whether we're sitting in the gutter. That's who the person next to us is, and that's who we are.
Do you see?
I've looked at every soul differently since that day.
Do you see the chaos in the world as even though we talk about the individual stuff, pain and suffering and loss as a wake-up call, do you see the bigger picture, the chaos that we create every day? I try to remind people of this. As far as I can tell, there's no alien species doing this to us. We do this to ourselves every day, 24/7, 365. As long as there's been more than three or four of us, we've been pushing each other apart and blaming each other and trying to say that you're different. Now, that's not everybody. But it seems to what pervades so much of the headlines. And I'm saying that the lifelines are more important. When you see all the chaos that goes on, and you just brought up this great example of someone who you served and ended up serving you, and this great amalgamation took place, are we getting anywhere, in your opinion? I mean, to me, all of these things seem to be, once again, opportunities in disguise to bring us together. It doesn't matter what the issue is, but the issue somehow becomes bigger than the actual opportunity.
I think that perhaps the most important thing we're here to learn on in this existence is love and empathy. Because when we start to see the other individual as ourselves, then we experience their challenges in their context, and all judgment stops, and there's only love. It's about getting to a place where we can look at another individual and honestly say in our hearts, I don't get their path. It's not what I do, but that doesn't matter. It's not my path. I don't have to explain it or rationalize it or justify it or try to make them conform to my path. They're on their path. All I need to do is honor it. And sometimes they're doing things that are really difficult for us to get our head around. They're doing things that we view as to be horrible, but we have to get ourselves to the point where we experience it in their context. When we hear about the horrible mass shooting, it's okay for our hearts to break for the victims, but we ought to allow our heart to break for the
perpetrator as well, when we ought to be asking ourselves, what happened to that soul that led them to do this thing? And I agree with you wholeheartedly. We spend way too much time dividing people and labeling them. And the problem with labels is you have to judge them. You have to judge something before you can label it, or you won't put the right label on it. The problem is we're not very good judges.
That's right. You know, I find it amazing that most Galapagos tortoises live longer than we do, but we know everything, right? So in the very minuscule amount of time we get a chance to be here, I find it, you know, the information that could lead to transformation is there, but you have to be able to ingest it and apply it. And I think that one of the things I appreciate about your work and what you do is that, again, you came from this very authentic, earth-sprung kind of existence. Without really setting out to do this, it kind of found you. But again, if we're following the line of this conversation, it was kind of meant to be. I've heard a lot of people say, whatever you're seeking is seeking you. Problem is, most people don't look for anything. We stop right at the end of social media or Facebook or Twitter or whatever. And I see these things as, you know, they feed the ego. They feed the part of us that wants to pretend like we're separate and all that kind of stuff. And yet at the end of the day, or at the beginning of the day, that stuff really only matters if you allow it to matter in your life. And so I find that all really another interesting observation in human behavior modification. And I don't know what to make of it all quite yet, but everything goes around, comes back around again. And I think that when you pile this stuff up, I think there is a part of people looking for a simpler time, a quieter time, a more peaceful time. And that stuff's only important, I guess, if you plug into it constantly. I'd rather be plugging into something away from on social media because it keeps me a little bit more grounded. But in the world today, you know, there's the great technology. I just spent 1 year on the air doing a daily talk show between Chicago and Beijing, China, during the most difficult relationship our two nations have ever had. And this came out of nowhere. And how it all happened is another one of those flick the dominoes and watch what happens and get out of the way. But 365 shows with total strangers 7,500 miles away that I've never seen face-to-face. We've never even FaceTime or anything like that. It's just through our voices. And we started the show with something and with nothing, and it became something. And as we've taken a short hiatus to kind of gather and see where this is all going to go next, I started to think about what that meant. That if we could connect with each other, literally halfway, if not three quarters of the way around the world, and still find common ground without having to ever be in the same zip code, to me, that proves something. That you can find that place just by listening to each other and not having to be right all the time.
I totally agree. A couple of weeks ago, I met with a client for lunch. As I mentioned to you before we came on air, I have a thing on my website. It's called Lunch with Jeff.
Right.
If people will buy me lunch, I'll sit down and spend a couple hours with them. And I've had some of the most incredible conversations with total strangers. And they'll tell me these profound experiences. And I'm just like, I can't believe I get to listen to this.
Yeah.
And frequently at the end of the conversation, they'll say, I've never told this to another individual.
Yes.
And so I had one of those lunches a couple of weeks ago with somebody who grew up in one religious tradition and married a person who grew up in another religious tradition. And they were making things work between the two of them. And after that, I came home and I got on Zoom. And I met with a client in New Zealand who was from India, who grew up Hindu but loved Buddhism and said, as she said, she likes truth from any source. And then a little bit later, that same day, I had a client near Denver, Colorado, who grew up in a Greek Orthodox tradition. And I said, oh, I love the Greek Orthodox tradition. She said, why? I said, because when they get married, a man walks behind the groom and a woman walks behind the bride and they hold a crown above their head. And their marriage is actually a coronation ceremony and they remember who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And so I get to meet with all these people around the world. I have clients in 10 countries now, thanks to COVID and Zoom.
Mm.
And I just love the diversity. And when I see them, I guess I'm strange because I see how we're so much alike rather than how we're different.
Yeah. The folks that I work with in China, Hu Young, one of the top broadcasters there, she's still on the air right now, fascinating and smart and speaks better English than I do. And Bebe, my other co-host, 40 years old, has a six-year-old daughter, and I'm Uncle John to Viv, and she's never met me. And that's just what's happened in a year. And I look at the opposite of that. You can see why, if you just focus on the headlines, why people stay separate. But the whole concept of the Bridge Show was to bring the world together one conversation at a time. That happens when you sit down at lunch. It's the same thing when you're Zooming with someone in New Zealand. It's just one conversation at a time. Last minute or two we have, Jeff. What do you think is it that stops us most as people from remembering who we are? What's the big speed bumper barrier for most people?
A lot of it is fear, of course. And ironically, there's this prayer that's been part of the Christian Eucharistic liturgy for over 500 years. I think it's called the Prayer of Humble Access. And there's a line in the prayer that says something like, "I'm not even worthy to gather the crumbs from under God's table." And I'm thinking to myself, if that's the message to your congregants, then what is the point? I mean, we're here because we're exactly the opposite of that. We are divine already. We are like our divine progenitors. Whatever religious tradition you come from, it sounds really anathema to the Western Judeo-Christian tradition, but in much of the Eastern philosophies, this notion of being divine fits very comfortably into their practice. And mm-hmm. I think the real key to finding the peace we're looking for in the world is to settle in and realize who we are already and accept it and stop fearing it and then just go out and treat everybody else like they're the same.
Yeah, there's no money in that. Sorry. There's no cash in that, Jeff.
Yeah.
I know.
Let's talk about sex and money for a while. And
exactly. That's where all the problems are at. If we would just do this other thing, it's okay, but it's not as good as this. What's the big aha for you? I wanted to go back and just dig a little deeper. You know, you've had these incredible experiences. The work you've done in the ER, you know, already gets you a place in Valhalla. But what's the big aha for you at the end of the day, the takeaway, when you kind of look back on your connected dot journey? What is it that resonates with you most on where you're at today?
Good question. I think I would normally answer that question by sharing an experience I had in the ER with a homeless man, but I already told you about that.
Yes, you did.
So that one really was an aha for me because it helped me realize who I am and who everyone else is. And if I can just remember that, when I can look at a soul that's struggling and just remember who they are and how we're alike, then I can treat them appropriately. A messenger came to me one day and said, "Every experience is to enable you to help someone else."
Hmm.
And I said, "Wait a minute, I thought experiences were for personal growth, and then I could go help other people if I wanted to." And the messenger said, "The primary purpose of every experience is to enable you to help someone else. You get the secondary benefit of personal growth."
Hmm.
Gave me a 180-degree turn on why we're here and why we have difficult experiences. And so I try never to ask, "Why me?" Instead, the questions I try to ask when I'm going through something that's really difficult is, "What can I learn from this experience, and how can I use it to help someone else?"
The book is called Not Yet, Near Life Experiences and Lessons Learned by Jeff O'Driscoll, MD. You can get it at Amazon.com. If you want to go to lunch with Jeff, I mean, you'd fly, right, to somebody's location. They just got to buy you lunch as long as they get your airline ticket, pick you up.
Yeah, if they cover my expenses, I'll meet them anywhere in the world.
You know what? I see a reality show here, brother. I'm not kidding. Like, can you imagine a camera crew following you around lunch with Jeff, and then you go fly to these exotic places or even Cleveland, and just the conversations you'd have with people would be brilliant.
I tell you what, if the conversations I have continue like they've been, I'd do it forever because I meet the most incredible people and they share the most profound experiences. And in fact, you can get little glimpses of some of my experiences on my website. If you go to the blog page on my website and read some of my blog posts, they're only a few paragraphs each. And a lot of them are ones that people I've talked with have given me permission to share.
The website is www.jeffodriscoll.com. Everything is there you need. Listen, that lunch thing, that was the first thing I saw when I went to your site. Now, that's a novel idea, so I'm glad that you brought that up. And I'm really looking forward to meeting you in person this weekend for the All Souls Weekend at Lake Geneva at the beautiful Abbey Resort. I think they sold the thing out, and I look forward to meet you there.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. And if people don't know how to spell my name, just go to helpingsoulsheal.com.
Great. Thanks very much, Jeff.
Take care.
Great conversation with Dr. Jeff O'Driscoll. That's the kind of stuff that just jacks my shorts up. You know, when I start these shows and I roll out that, you know, time to go in the outdoor, up the down staircase, find sense in the senseless, and if at all possible, find the obvious buried in the absurd, I don't do that because it's a great bumper sticker. It would be a great bumper sticker, but I do it because I mean it. And to me, my life has been about those things. Any transformation that's come on in my time and any changes that have come over me over the decades I've been alive comes out from those things. In the outdoor, up the down staircase, look to find sense in the senseless. That's around us all the time. And finding the obvious buried in the absurd, quite frankly, even gets easier over time. Because when you step back and you study history, for example, we've done this a million times over. Every problem we have today, every challenge we have today, every malady we have today, this is nothing new. It's only new because it's on our watch. But when you study history, you realize, yeah, I've done this before. Just had a different cast of characters. And if we don't learn from history, what is it, kids? We're doomed to frickin' repeat it. Anyway, great stuff. If you want to get Jeff's book, again, it's called Not Yet, Near-Life Experiences and Lessons Learned by Dr. Jeff O'Driscoll. And you can get that at Amazon.com and all the other dot-coms as well. Thanks so much for listening and spending time with me today. Thanks to my sponsors who make this all possible. Until next time, safe travels. Adios.